You know, these days it seems as though there might just be conspiracy against hope. It's hard to look on the bright side of life with all the events of the past 3 weeks alone that constantly tell us that we are in danger of destruction, when we've seen that a few people can put an end to life as we know it. It's reasonable. Well, let's change that. Is it reasonable to still have hope in the face of all this? Or is it only logical to resort to despair, disbelief, fear, and cynicism? Being aware of the overwhelming and irrepressible evil in our world can often cause people to lose hope and to lose faith in a God who cares. We only need to look back some 80 years ago, as we did, in fact, last weekend, to Kristallnacht and to the Holocaust. We only need to look back that far to find an example of an evil so great that many lost all hope and all faith. And yet, even the Holocaust, through the Holocaust, faith and hope survived. Listen to the words of a young girl who wrote in her diary. It is utterly impossible for me to build my life on a foundation of chaos, suffering, and death. I see the world being slowly transformed into a wilderness. I hear the approaching thunder that one day will destroy us too. I feel the suffering of millions. And yet, when I look up at the sky, I somehow feel that this cruelty too shall end, that peace and tranquility will return once more. End quote. So wrote the young Jewish girl Anne Frank during the height of the Holocaust. There was another who went through the camps himself, Viktor Frankl, as he wrote In Search for Meaning. He pointed out the reason why those who survived did survive in most cases. Namely, it was those who had hope who were able to pull through. And then there were those men and women marching out of the Warsaw ghetto on their way to the death camps, who recited the 12th article of Maimonides' Affirmation, the 13 Principles of Faith. They said, Me'amim be'emunah shleima, I believe with perfect faith in the coming of the Messiah. From such a horrific episode in our history, we see that hope can survive even in the worst of conditions. Now, I'm not going to get into all the questions related to what those events mean to faith and hope in God. I did so in an article many years ago in a journal called Judaism, and you can get that article if you're interested, called God After the Holocaust. But I want to move to today. Today, while we do struggle to understand the persecution our ancestors went through, each of us must individually grapple with the question of how we can hope when all seems hopeless. Some have suggested that to keep our faith and our hope alive, we must modify what it is that we believe in. A number of years ago, Harold Kushner, the rabbi, wrote a book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. He was prompted to do so by the death of his own son. Rabbi Kushner's answer to the question of why bad things happen to good people is that while God is good, he is not all-powerful. So Rabbi Kushner remakes God with limitations to make faith easier and tragedy more bearable. But let me suggest that if our God is not all-powerful, then what reason do we have to hope? Because then evil can ultimately conquer. And if our hope is irrelevant, then why have faith? After all, faith in God has traditionally been the source of strength that enables people who are surrounded by adversity to overcome it. Now look, the faith that we're talking about is not just a belief that God exists. More than that, it's a personal trust in God, a God who is active in history. He's a God who can not only part the sea of reeds, he is in fact a God who knows us personally and cares for us individually. And for those who will take some of the yeshiva courses, we talked about that kind of God being presented in the gospel of Matthew and Mark just last night. So for those in the classes, a review. For those not in the classes, a commercial. Take the classes. if you hadn't figured that's what the commercial was. A God who knows us personally and cares for us individually. Not just a God, but our God. A God who has said to us, Jeremiah 29:11, "For I know the plans that I have for you, plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope." In fact, our liturgy has at its heart this very same hope and trust in a supremely powerful God who loves and who cares. It's epitomized, perhaps, in the words of Adon Olam. You know, we sing it from time to time. "Then in his hand myself I lay, and trusting sleep, to wake with cheer. My life I give into his care. The Lord does guard, I have no fear." And as we responded with Kaddish, it reflects the same kind of thing in times of difficulty, because Kaddish is often, as you recall, said during times of difficulty. In times of difficulty, we have a God who does guard, therefore we need not have fear. And Judaism reminds us regularly that faith is essential for a real relationship with God. So at the heart of the rabbinic literature, the Talmud says, and I quote, "Seven qualities avail before the throne of glory: faith, righteousness, justice, loving kindness, mercy, truth, and peace. These represent the crowning virtues, and the first place is assigned to faith, the principle upon which the whole relationship of man with God ultimately rests," end quote. The Shema itself, which we affirmed a little earlier, is an acknowledgement of God's power, as well as a response of personal trust in our powerful God. Moreover, when we studied the heroes and heroines of the Scriptures, we see that God did not abandon them during times of great difficulty, even when their circumstances seem to indicate his absence. Jacob, Joseph, and Job. Oh, three J's. Sounds almost like a music group. Anyhow, Jacob, Joseph, and Job all had their hope in God tested in various difficult circumstances, and all were able to continue to put their faith into action. Prior to the text that was read tonight from last week's parasha, near the end, the text reads, "So Esau hated Jacob because of what he had done to him. He said to himself, 'My father will soon be gone, and then I will kill Jacob.'" And then, as you heard read first by Matt, and then by Virginia, "So Jacob left Beersheba and journeyed toward Haran." Look, Matt already hinted at this, the hopelessness and difficulty of Jacob's situation. His father was dead. He would never again see his mother. His brother had murder on his heart. His murder. And yet the text says, Jacob departed from Beersheba. Now, for the purpose of this story, it would have been sufficient to say merely, he went to Haran. Would have been far simpler. Therefore, the sages, the rabbis of old, infer that Jacob's departure from Beersheba had a significance of its own. And in fact, the great rabbinic commentator of the 11th century, Rashi, suggests that what the text is telling us is what you have here is a righteous person's departure. A righteous person's departure. And so in verse 11, we go on to read that he arrived in that place. Now, that place, or this place, was Mount Moriah, the site where Abraham bound Isaac on the altar and where the temple would later stand, as our traditions put the text together. Therefore, the sages interpret the term Yifgah, often translated came upon, which usually does mean encountered, they interpret it to have the less common meaning, namely prayed. So, as the text may be clearly indicating to us, Jacob's primary encounter was not with a geographical location, but with God himself. Oh, and by the way, One of the more prominent names that our sages of old had for God is Hamakom, the place, just as you have it in this text. So, Vayifka Hamakom, he encountered the place. He encountered God. Now, since the verse states that this took place just before he retired for the night, the rabbis of old credit Jacob, and I love the way they put this together, credit Jacob with instituting what's called the evening prayer, Aravit. It's an indicator, it's an indication of his hope and his trust. And so we read in verse 12, he lay down to sleep and dreamed that a staircase reached from earth to heaven, and he saw the angels of God going up and down on it. I think I've said this before. Others have as well. Notice, they didn't come down and go up. They went up and came down. The angels were already accompanying him. At the top of the stairs stood the Lord. I am the Lord, he said, the God of Abraham and of your father Isaac. The ground you are lying on is yours. I will give it to you and to your descendants. I will bring you back safely to this land. Now notice what he said next. I will be with you constantly. And it goes on to say, until I finish giving you all that I'm promising. If you haven't already realized what that is the definition of, it's the definition of the name by which God introduced himself to Moses at the burning bush. Not I am who I am, which is the way it's often translated, but I'm the God who will go with you constantly, with the implication as it is here, until I have finished giving you all I am promising. Oh, and by the way, he isn't finished giving us all that he's promising, so he's still going with us. It was God's promises then, as the text tells us, that enabled Jacob to persevere through years of an experience with Laban, the Aramean. Remember we talked about this last week? The name for deceiver is not Jacob. The name for the deceiver is Aramean. It's the term for deceiver. And Laban was the Aramean, the deceiver. Anyhow, so God's promises enabled him to persevere through those years with this deceiver, plus the years of infertility of Rachel, and then to return to fulfill his commitment, as verse 22 goes on to say in the text. And this memorial pillar shall become a place for worship, and I will give you back a tenth of everything you give me. That hope that Jacob had settled his heart and secured his path. Joseph is another person who spent a great deal of his life in very difficult circumstances. You remember the story. It's a story we're going to get into very shortly. He got caught up in the middle of jealousies and rivalries. So his early years consisted of alienation from his brothers, physical mistreatment, and, if you would have it, a virtual kidnapping and near murder arranged by those brothers of his. At that point in the story, his story takes a turn. It would appear for the better as Joseph rises in the Egyptian ranks. But soon, the wife of Joseph's supervisor attempts to seduce him. And when Joseph maintains his integrity and refuses her, she turns on him, and he's put in prison. Not because of any wrong on his part, but because of his integrity. Joseph's experiences should have destroyed him. Instead, he continued to hope and to trust in God. And so he was able to tell his brothers many years later, at the end of the book of Genesis, chapter 50, "And as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." Joseph's trust shows that faith in God can help us to face and, in fact, overcome adversity. But perhaps the supreme example of faith through suffering is still Job. And in Job's case, it seems that initially his faith is precisely what got him into trouble in the first place. You see, the biblical account pictures Job's calamities as arising from Hasatan, Satan's challenge to God to test Job's faith. So attacked by Satan, and actually by his own friends as well, Job is ultimately affirmed by God. Interestingly, one of the book's striking moments is when God reminds Job who the creator and the continuer of the universe is. And in response to This display of God's power, Joseph reclaimed, pardon me, Joseph. Too many J's in there. Job. No, John. No. Job reclaims his uncompromising faith. He rejects the possibility that God is absent or limited. Remember his words earlier in the book of Job, in the heart of it all, as he's going through it all. Even though the Lord should slay me, still I will hope in him. And that hope is vindicated. Despite the circumstances, despite the doubts and the discouragements thrown our way, God wants us to maintain our hope and to express our trust in him. A young boy was sitting on a park bench. He was happily humming and singing softly to himself. Soon along came a young man who had recently completed his degree at a local university. At this point, the young man, the graduate, feeling very enlightened and very eager to show his brilliance. So he asked this boy, this young boy, why he was so happy. The boy asked, with a bright laugh, "Do you have any idea of what God is able to do? I just read that God opened up the Sea of Reeds and let the whole nation of Israel right through the middle." He must have been going to one of her Shabbat school classes. The new graduate laughed lightly, sat down next to the boy, and began to try to open his eyes to the reality of the miracles of the Bible. He said, "You know, these can all be easily explained. Modern scholarship has shown that the Sea of Reeds in that area was only 10 inches deep at the time. So it was no real problem for the Israelites to just wade across." At this, the boy was stumped. The man was content that he had enlightened the poor, naive young person to the finer points of scientific insight, and so he turned to leave. But before he had taken even two steps, the boy shouted, "Wow! God is even greater than I thought. Not only did he lead the whole nation of Israel through the Sea of Reeds, he topped it off by drowning the whole Egyptian army in just 10 inches of water." As he did for those people who crossed that Sea of Reeds, so God asks us to trust him, even when circumstances seem hopeless. Questions like, why is God allowing this to happen? And where is God during this crisis? These are not new, friends. People have been wrestling with them for ages. So it raises the question for us, why are these accounts of faith and hope recorded in the Scriptures for us? Let me suggest, so that we can remember that our God parted the Sea of Reeds, that he fed us with manna in the wilderness, and he brought us into the Promised Land. They're there so that we can be reminded that our God is in fact all-powerful, and he is caring and loving as well. And this is striking. And he shares in our suffering. When Moses went back to his second job interview, Exodus 6, verses 5 through 7, God said, "I have seen their suffering. I have heard their cries. In effect, I have mourned along with them." Because God is present, because God is a feeling and caring God as well as a God who knows all things, he suffers with each victim of grief. He mourns with every person who loses a loved one and suffers with everyone who is sick and grieves with us in our despair and discouragement. Because of this, even if there were no completely satisfying answers for difficulties and for evil, there is a reason for hope. Knowing that God suffers with those who suffer gives us a reason to trust him and to love him even more. He knows what we are going through and he has not abandoned us. Remember the name from the bush? I will go with them wherever they go, constantly and through all circumstances. And in fact, the Torah virtually closes on those words. It's chapter 31, not chapter 34, but it's close enough to the end. Don't be afraid. I will never leave you, nor will I abandon you. And that, too, is the encouragement from the Haftarah portion for this week, part of which was read. The God who sees, too, even those who sometimes wander off, and brings them back to Himself. However, let me suggest that the greatest evidence we have of God's continual presence and strength is, in fact, our Messiah, who bore on Himself our griefs and our burdens. Not on Himself, in Himself. Those who have been faithful throughout our history have rooted their trust in the expected final vindication of faith in the Messianic age, when evil and turmoil will be dealt a crushing blow. So to repeat the words of those leaving the Warsaw ghetto into the death camps, Me'amim be'emunah shleimah, I believe with perfect faith in the coming of the Messiah. So for thousands of years, our people have trusted that God would in fact send His promised Messiah to a grieving and suffering planet. Through every difficulty, we have traditionally looked for the Messiah to destroy evil and to vindicate our faith in God. It is this hope that has nourished our faith. It is this hope that we will express yet again in a few short minutes when we rise for the Elenin. It's the time when the world will be perfected under the rule of the Lord Almighty. We understand it to be the time of the kingdom of David's greater son. When all evil, as the Elenin reminds us, will be wiped away. In fact, among His many titles, among the Messiah's many titles, is the one, the suffering servant. And again, back to last night's class, we were talking about this last night. If you weren't there, I'm sorry you missed it. And you know what I'm going to say next. Come to class. Anyhow, one of His major titles is suffering servant. It's as if to imply that the Messiah Himself knows all too well the meaning of pain and suffering. So Isaiah wrote of Him, "Surely our griefs He Himself bore, and our sorrows He personally carried." Which is exactly what we need to hear and understand. Yeshua knew suffering from firsthand experience, and He expressed compassion and solidarity for and solidarity with people who suffer. In a classic text in Matthew chapter 9, He saw the crowds, and He saw how downtrodden and hopeless they appeared to be. And He felt compassion on them. This was the time when He was healing them as well. Nobody's life is free from pain or anxiety. But then, should we give in to despair or fear and cynicism? If these things, anxiety and pain, characterize our lives? Or should we refashion God into an image that seems more palatable? Or perhaps, can we allow Yeshua, the promised Messiah, to give hope and to bring healing? The 18th century poet Moshe Ephraim, who must have been a Hindu. Come on, wake up, people. Moshe Ephraim said, "We trust a star to guide our way when on the open sea. Why trust we not the Lord of stars on earth our guide to be?" There's no reason to lose hope. Remember, faith and hope that survive adversity are stronger than faith and hope that have not been tested. I was reminded of this when one of our friends in family members here at the synagogue, Doreen German, posted this a little more than 2 weeks ago. "When you're in a dark place, you sometimes tend to think you've been buried. Perhaps you've just been planted. So bloom." So activate your hope and trust in God who said, in the text I quoted earlier, from Jeremiah. Jeremiah was speaking to people getting ready to be carried off into captivity. And God speaks through Jeremiah in those circumstances, and He says, "For I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. Against all hope, we do have hope. Take the next minute or so, the time of reflection in quiet.